Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute this evening, where Dr. Zenny Edwards makes a welcome first appearance on the occasion of the publication of her book, A Life of Purpose, a biography of John Silman. Now, I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Zenny Edwards is a consulting architectural historian and an acknowledged author, biographer, and curator. Her publications include the biographies of photographers Harold Casno and Max DePayne, monographs on architects B.J. Waterhouse, the Vernons, Howard Joslan, and Leith McCready, and architectural histories on such topics as Women's College. Our speaker completed her doctorate in architectural history at the UTS in 2006, and tonight she's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on Silman, prodigy of his generation. Zenny Edwards, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard. Welcome, and thank you for asking me tonight to talk to you about such a big biography. So what I'll do is I'll skim. But first of all, I'd like to acknowledge David Carmont, who is the great-grandson of John Silman, who's here today. So he will support me when you ask your questions, I hope. I tried to see Silman as his contemporaries saw him, to locate him within the professional and cultural contexts to which he gravitated, to judge him in accordance with the values and standards of his own time rather than ours. At various times, Silman linked the etymology of the name to possible Islamic, Sulaiman the Great, for example, and Semitic, Salome, Solomon. Despite the push and pull of these opposites, the name Silman is simply a derivative of Soilman, adapted to depict the way of life of his farmer ancestors. John Silman had been born twice before, the third son of John and Martha. He was the first of three boys, all named John, to survive infancy. Born on 29th of August 1849, innocence and mischief defined Silman's childhood. As a child of five and a half, he was prone to tantrums, at a few instances throwing himself down the cellar steps in a fit of passion. The family doctor prescribed not medicine but discipline, which led his parents to send him to a girls' school to board for a year. But even that did not work. He was a sickly child and through the years suffered physical breakdowns. His father was a shopkeeper who dealt in fancy goods, more trinkets than jewelry, and later turned to speculative building with his son as his apprentice. Silman, at an early age, began to learn the tricks as well as the pitfalls of the trade. At 16, Silman designed a family home, Derwent Villa, in Ashburton Road, Surrey. Later, he admitted it was something he was not proud of because it was clumsy and vernacular. He studied at the Architectural Association until 1869. He was not the golden boy at the association despite being an assiduous student. He was articled with various architects, some good, many bad. He studied at the Architectural Association until 1869. He was not the golden boy at the association despite being a diligent student. He was articled with various architects, some good, many bad. Developed his networking talents and expanded his architectural knowledge at the RIBA library, including spending his student days tracing illustrations from Violette Leduc's dictionary the 10-volume book of illustrations because he didn't have any money to purchase them. A Puget Sound scholarship honed his analytical skills of medieval and Gothic architecture. For the Puget scholar, God indeed was in the detail, and Suman's drawings captured on paper many godly inspired creations, which he compiled in a sketchbook of massive size and bound in leather and gilt. It weighed a good 12 kilograms. Through the years, Suman learned the value of enterprise and honed his skills at networking. And despite an initial temerity, he learned to seize every opportunity that came along on the chance of gaining work from it. Influential patrons took him under their wing. The first of these was J.C. Galloway, high up in the British Congregational Society. At 21, through Galloway, Suman secured his first official commission to design Dedham Congregational Church in Essex. With a successful Dedham commission giving him public exposure, Suman quickly hit his stride. The second patron was William Garland Soper, resident and major landholder of Caterham in Surrey. Soper, a staunch Congregationalist, was a London merchant with questionable business dealings in the Cape Colony and South Africa. And the third mentor was Suman's future father-in-law, Thomas Redgate, deacon at the George Street Congregational Church at Croydon. With the intercession of these three, Suman secured the commission to design Caterham Congregational Church. The first official ceremony at Caterham was the wedding of Suman to Sarah Clark Redgate on April 15, 1875. Not much later, Suman designed the largest domestic commission for Soper's mansion, Hairstone, in a valley not far from the church. His magnificent color renderings of Hairstone were exhibited at the Royal Academy and critiqued as a work of art on paper, although closer analysis hint at Suman doing a bit of cooking, manipulating the perspective to make the building more imposing than it actually was. More church commissions followed in succession, foretelling that congregational commissions would become the mainstay of his career. He took in a partner, John Rhodes, who manned the practice on Suman's absence due to illness and commissions. Over the years, the Suman and Rhodes partnership established a reputation for reliability and diligence. "Let the job speak for itself," was their motto. The partnership and friendship came to an irreconcilable end due to Rhodes' eccentric Anglican evangelism bordering on lunacy. Suman's career success was timely, riding the wave of Victoria's golden years. It was a glory period of peace, libertarianism, prosperity, industrial wealth, and political power, all these reflected in its architecture. Although a star on the rise, Suman never achieved star status. The location of most of Suman's churches in country towns and villages may have limited recognition of his designs to local folk. An exception was the George Street Schools, named after the shipbuilder of the Blackwall Yard. And popular local nonconformist philanthropist who commissioned Suman to design a school that would provide free board, clothing, and secondary education for all the children in the neighborhood of Blackwall and Poplar. In the early 1880s, Suman suffered one of his most serious nervous breakdowns. He went to Europe with his parents for 2 months to recuperate, only to return to a wife who had become desperately ill with consumption, exacerbated by the rearing of three young children and the frequent lengthy absences of a husband deeply engrossed in his career. "The only cure would be to go to a warmer climate," doctors said. Hence, the inevitable decision by Suman to move his family to Australia. One can only surmise that Suman leaving for Australia at 36 years of age, at the rise of a promising career, may have cut off any opportunity for him to make a name for himself in England. His permanent absence eventually erased whatever memory there may have been of his work. Compendiums of Victorian architects and architecture do not include John Suman in their dictionaries or biographical indices. Publications featuring articles about his work, more often than not, erroneously spelled his name or came up with a different name altogether. Critical reviews appeared many decades later after Suman had left England, and they were not complimentary. "Rather emphatic, sometimes clumsy," wrote one critic, "and a survival of high Victorian heaviness," wrote another. Nevertheless, it is heartening to know that the dwindling congregations presently worshipping in extant Suman-designed churches in England still regard them with a high degree of pride and affection. Suman was instantly captivated by Sydney's charm. "Sydney unfolds," he said, followed by acclamations of the harbour which outshone everything else. He could not have chosen a better time to arrive in Australia. The country was still in the midst of a building boom, and the building industry had become Sydney's biggest single industry. Sydney buzzed with tremendous activity with the construction of houses, commercial institutions, and transport facilities. But its downplan begged improvement, and Suman was determined to do something about it. Suman wasted no time in finding out who was who in Sydney. Immediately, Suman called on Josiah Mullins, founder and president of the Sydney Stock Exchange and a prominent resident of Burwood, west of Sydney. Mullins, in turn, introduced the Sumans to architect Harry Chambers Gett and his wife. That introduction provides Suman a foothold into the elite architectural circle of Sydney. In April 1886, Suman had acquired a new office at Bank Chambers in Jamieson Street in Sydney, and noted that Today opened it for business. A few months later, Suman bought a half share into the practice of Charles Blackman for £3,000. Suman was enticed by Blackman's lucrative practice, his book showing a net profit of £6,000 per annum, an impressive client list that included Australian joint stock banks, the Australian Mutual Provident Society, and the Mutual Life Association. The partnership of Blackman and Suman at George Street, Sydney, was officially announced in October 1886 in a public notice in the Sydney Morning Herald. 6 months into the partnership, Blackman went on an extended holiday overseas, and Suman clearly felt proud to be left in charge of the practice. Things seemed to be going smoothly until Suman discovered that Blackman had no intention of returning to Australia after his alleged holiday had, in fact, absconded to New Zealand with his mistress. Suman wrote, "From the day of Blackman's departure, I never saw him again." It came out later that he had gone away with the barmaid and left his wife and family behind. The Equity Court, which with Adrian Knox as Suman's legal counsel, dissolved the partnership on April 1888. It took Suman nearly 3 years before he could pay off Blackman's share and an extra sum to obtain sole ownership of the practice. The professional tragedy affected not only Suman, but the whole family. The emotional trauma aggravated Sarah's health, and his parents considered the situation grave enough for them to hastily travel to Australia in 1887 to help their son cope with the crisis. They never left Australia. In 1886, to raise his reputation as an architect of influence, Suman established the club, the Pelagians, as a response to concerns raised by the Royal Institute of British Architects that professional ethics in Australia were at the low ebb, and that the local institute had only 20 members and had practically no influence. The 12 founding members of the Pelagians were already notably recognised in New South Wales and immediately attracted the interest of the press. Unbeknownst to its members, the Pelagians was the principal factor in Suman's calculated plan to get a foothold in the institute. The Pelagians did not waste any time to request to amalgamate with the institute, and the terms of amalgamation were adopted by the institute with much satisfaction at the election of office bearers. Suman, despite his lobbying, failed to become president. It clearly showed that the club members saw through the preemptive machinations and that he had overestimated his appeal. Suman was ostracized for wearing his Englishness and professional status heavily. They perceived him as the archetypal English colonist, astonished newcomer, enabled by the virtues of his professional standing in England to be the conquering hero in the yet infant territory. The manner in which Suman actively promoted himself aroused antipathy among other architects, but the most vitriolic antagonism was to come from Canadian-born architect John Horbury Hunt. Hunt, 11 years Suman senior, described Suman as the young English gentleman recently come amongst us for damaging the profession. He sarcastically referred to Suman and the Pelagians as Messrs. Treachery, Jealousy, and Cult. Those remarks, according to Hunt's biographer, Professor Max Freeland, were the first shots in a battle that was to last till death. Hunt, rather than Suman, succeeded Rowe as president of the Institute. That was the ultimate blow to Suman's bid for power. During the 7 years of Hunt's presidency, Suman attended only one Institute meeting. Freeland suggests that Hunt and Suman had become victims of their own battle. Two individualistic by nature, uncooperative and potential rivals, and not a little jealous. Few of them walk with the angels, he said, but also few of them tread with the devil. Most of them do a little of both. In 1930, Suman established and funded the Suman Award for Architecture, still regarded today as the most prestigious award by the Institute of Architects. The award ensured that Suman's name would be inextricably linked with the Institute to perpetuate his memory for all time. Many would now consider this award as Suman's own form of vindication and a way to ensure his legacy would be acknowledged for all time. Suman used all of avenues of opportunity to promote himself. His adroit use of press became more directly apparent through the first class trade journal with Australian Builder and Contractors News. He published a series of groundbreaking articles in an Australian style, which catapulted the paper into being regarded the mouthpiece of architects. In July 1887, Suman was appointed by the Senate of the University of Sydney to give a series of 40 lectures on building construction and the history of architecture. His star pupil was J.J.C. Bradfield, who topped the class and was later awarded a Bachelor of Engineering degree with honors, the University Gold Medal, and the Suman Prize for Architecture. Prophetically, Bradfield's final year project was a design for a bridge. In 1889, Suman acquired a partner, Joseph Porter Power. Power oversaw all commissions during Suman's frequent absences through illness and overseas travel. The Walker family, particularly Thomas and James Walker, took Suman under their wing, and from whom Suman would obtain major commissions. In 1888, John Suman was awarded the commission to design the Thomas Walker Convalescent Hospital, which should have been, for all intents and purposes, awarded to another architect, John Kirkpatrick. A competition was held, which Kirkpatrick won, and which Suman did not even gain a place. A month later, news got around that Suman had been awarded the commission to design the hospital. Why Kirkpatrick lost the commission to Suman is not clearly documented, but it was obvious that Suman had exerted influence over the adjudicators and trustees of the Walker estate. The trustees officially awarded the commission to John Suman on 31 December 1888, the day Suman's wife, Sarah, died, occurring while he was at the Yarala Chambers, showing the Walkers the plans for the new hospital. It was also through the Walkers that Suman would meet his future second wife. Thomas Walker, a widower, called upon his sister Joanna to serve as a surrogate mother for his 8-year-old daughter Edith. To provide her motherless niece a playmate and companion, Joanna adopted 6-year-old Annie Elizabeth Masefield, daughter of her friend George Masefield. Joanna Walker met with Suman, the widower, privately just prior to her death in 1890, to discuss with him the possibility of leaving Annie in his care as his wife. Annie, 15 years Suman's junior, was to become Suman's second wife in 1893. They were to have 4 children. In 1896, Suman presented to State Parliament 2 private bills for a tunnel under the harbour from North Shore to the city, centering on the thesis that the tunnel connection had become the preferred scheme overseas and by engineering standards was far more advanced technologically than any other means of crossing. I think I'm running late. It's a Thomas Rock. In October 1912, J.J.C. Bradfield's proposal for a cantilever bridge was accepted by the authorities, and he was assigned to work exclusively on the project and given the new position of engineer in charge of Sydney Harbour Bridge and City Transit. Suman, undeterred, was determined to put his imprint on the Sydney Harbour Bridge scheme any way he could. On 16 June 1924, Suman met with the bridge contractor, Sir John Burnett, at his Bedford Square office in London to convince him not to continue the road arch along the width of the bridge. He was obviously successful in that regard. The MacArthur Onslow's Friends of the Walkers became Suman's clients in 1894 when they commissioned Suman to design 2 gate lodges for Camden Park, the home of John MacArthur. Later, Suman designed for MacArthur's great-grandson, James, a gentleman's country resident named Gilbula, which would enhance but not overshadow the grandeur of Camden Park. That's Gilbula. In 1888, Suman supported Prime Minister Henry Park's recommendation to erect a grand memorial structure in Sydney to commemorate 100 years of British settlement. Suman submitted the design for a centennial monument to grace the entrance of Sydney Harbour, depicting symbolic figures of colossal proportions, one a goddess-like figure emerging from the sandstone outcrops of Sydney, casting her benevolent gaze across the harbour. Suman saw himself as a bold ideal of downplanners in Australia, but more so as a sort of John the Baptist crying in the wilderness, the saviour to redeem the country from the perils of bad town planning. The Town Planning Association was established at the public meeting held in the vestibule of Sydney Town Hall on 17th October 1913, with Suman as president. Immediately, Suman recommended buildings of poor character in Macquarie Street should be demolished, the land cleared and assumed for the building of new houses of Parliament, the public library, the town hall, and other municipal buildings. The buildings would only be built of the beautifully colored Pyrmont sandstone. Because Hyde Park was made of brick, Sulman recommended that it be demolished. The sandstone buildings already in place, such as St. Mary's Cathedral, the Register General's Office, the Australian Museum, and Sydney Grammar School, would be retained. Canberra, because of his pioneering role in the town planning movement in Australia, it was expected that Sulman's involvement in the planning process to choose the site for the federal capital would be assured. But for unknown reasons, the government overlooked Sulman for the selection committee. The competition to design the federal capital was announced on 30th April 1911. Walter Burley Griffin, a comparatively unknown architect, was declared the winner of the competition from 137 entrants. From the moment of his arrival in Sydney on 19th August 1913, Griffin was treated with hostility by departmental directors and several ministers of government. On 16th of October 1913, Griffin was appointed Federal Capital Director of Design and Construction with the principal role of supervising all work to be done in Canberra. The position, although impressive on paper, was problematic in practice, complicated by the antagonism from the departmental officers and by almost constant arguments with whom he was required to work. The strained working relationship between government and Griffin prevailed through the next 7 years until his tenuous position of authority was toppled when the board's plan, and not his, was accepted by Parliament, which approved work to commence at once. It was clear that certain members of the board were intent on destabilizing not only Griffin's plan, but also Griffin himself. Sulman figured prominently as Griffin's staunchest ally during these tumultuous times, addressing Parliament to voice his support for Griffin's plan on several occasions. In 1914, Sulman gave evidence at the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Public Works, strongly urging the authorities to allow Griffin, as author of the premiated design, to carry out his own plan in his own way without any interference. On 2nd January 1921, the Hughes government appointed a Federal Capital Advisory Committee with Sulman as chairman. Despite Sulman's earlier support of him, Griffin had come to suspect that Sulman, in accepting the chairmanship of the committee, had become party to the same evils which he strenuously fought against on Griffin's behalf. Sulman wrote, "I am not accepting any fees for my work, which will be onerous, and one reason being that I have no wish to profit by a fellow architect's disappointment. In fact, it means actual loss of money as well as time, but I'm willing to make the sacrifice if by so doing I can serve the Commonwealth." And so in 1921, the Federal Capital Advisory Committee commenced to implement Griffin's plan for Canberra without the participation of its creator. The Federal Capital Advisory Committee disbanded in 1924. Not much later, Sulman went to England to receive his knighthood for the role he performed in the development of Canberra. It was a poorly kept secret that Sulman extracted a tacit agreement from the government that he would accept the honorary position at the FCAC on condition that he would be granted a knighthood for his services. In the family archive, is a photograph of Sulman almost camouflaged by the bush on Goat Island. All one can see is his hatted head and coated frame. He shields his eyes from the sun and contemplates the harbour which had occupied him through most of his life in Australia. Sydney Harbour had tested and tempted him, particularly in how to conserve its beauty. The octopus that had captured his imagination in 1885 had given him so much cause for disappointment. And possibly the worst of all these disappointments was building of the Sydney Harbour Bridge itself. Suman's contribution to Australia is not restricted to architecture, but represents all fields of human endeavour through one of the longest presidencies of the National Art Gallery of Australia of New South Wales from 1919 to 1934. As an educator at the University of Sydney from 1887 to 1912 and again from 1919 to 1926, and as president of the Town Planning Association from 1913 to 1925. He was for over 60 years a member of the RIBA and one of its oldest members, having been elected as associate in 1872 and a fellow in 1883. During his last days, he suffered hallucinations and became violent, at one time hitting out at Annie and with clenched fists. He could not recognize his children. Included in the entries of Annie's diary were several accounts of Suman's insistence at wanting to go home, and of Annie telling him gently that he was already home. The home Suman possibly meant may have been the home of his birth and childhood. During a stormy day on 18th August 1934, Annie wrote in her diary that John passed away peacefully at 2:15 p.m. Suman's epitaph on the grey granite slab on Gore Hill bears no testimonial to his great achievements, but is simply inscribed Sir John Suman, son of John and Martha Suman. Thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Edwards for a fine presentation tonight on Sir John Suman. So we come to questions and discussion. Anne and I have got microphones. And after the function, there'll be copies of Zinni Edwards' A Life of Purpose, a biography of John Suman, available. And I'm sure the author would be happy to sign them. And so if you just come back here and speak into the microphone, I will disappear in a minute. Just tell us, I mean, towards the end you mentioned a disappointment about the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Now, as you know, the Sydney Harbour Bridge is probably the best known construction in Australia. What was the clash with Bradfield? What was the extent of Suman's disappointment?
Suman wanted to build a tunnel because he said that was the most technologically advanced, and it was safer, and it wouldn't hamper the view, that majestic view of the Sydney Harbour, with building the bridge. And J.J.C. Bradfield, being an engineer with a particular like for bridges, argued otherwise. So it was a very tense debate between the two, and also between architects and who supported the tunnel and other architects who didn't support the tunnel. With Suman, everything becomes a personal thing. I mean, he's a very competitive, and he wants to win at all costs. So, but in this case, he lost.
So did he ever comment on the structure, on the plans that got approved for the Harbour Bridge?
He wasn't asked to comment. He was really put aside by that. But what he did, he was living in Kirribilli by this time, at McMahon's Point, with the direct view of the Harbour Bridge. And in his archive are photographs of the bridge as it's being built. So he obviously took a lot of interest in it. But when it was being built, he really didn't have any say in it. But when he wrote the town planning book, that definitive book on town planning, he again proposed that the tunnel was obviously the better alternative than the bridge.
Well, he sort of, by the end, he'd sort of come even, hadn't he? Because a tunnel went up.
Yeah, but they're just dead by then.
Well, and
it wasn't called the Suman Tunnel.
Should it have been called the Suman Tunnel?
Well, he would have wanted it to be called the Suman Tunnel, I'm sure. But I don't know. I'm being facetious here. With David is probably turning over in in horror about. Suman was that sort of man. He was quite egoistic in a way. I mean, you wouldn't be surprised. He worked very, very hard. At one point, standing in the middle of a street counting cars. You know, that's the sort of thing he did. He really did work hard, and you just marvel at how much work and travel he put into it, considering travel at that time was really quite long.
Right, so there's a question here. Okay.
I'm interested in Sulman's relations with the Griffins. As you probably know, when Griffin was awarded the plan, there was no... it was not envisaged that he would actually come out to Australia, and there was a group of people, I think including Sulman, and the Taylors, I think, particularly George Taylor, who advocated for Griffin to come out. But at a certain point, the Taylors fell out very badly with the Griffins, and I'm not quite sure where how Sulman changed his view. I mean, maybe you can describe perhaps the changing relationship between Sulman and the Griffins, because he also had a relationship with Marion, who at one point became involved in the town planning association and then ended up having a huge fight with Florence. But I'm interested to know why perhaps he, as initially a supporter of Griffin, perhaps fell out or became a critic of Griffin.
It wasn't Griffin, it was Marion who really despised Sulman, and I think she had influenced Griffin, and Griffin then became suspicious of John Sulman. Griffin himself had faults. I mean, he didn't want to listen to anybody except follow his plan to the letter. And then the board, how bureaucratic the board could be, kept questioning. And I mean, it's Jorn Utzon all over again, isn't it? So that. It's just a clash of personalities, for one, not just from between Sulman and the Griffins, or the Taylors, George and Florence, with the Griffins, but the Griffins with the authorities and the departmental officers and other architects who were involved in it. Everybody had to have a say. So, in a way, it became so convoluted that Griffin had to leave. And Sulman had to sort of, I'm not defending Sulman, but Sulman had to make do with what he's got. But in the way Sulman introduced another component to Canberra, which he made into a garden city, which is not really what Griffin wanted in the first place.
Were all architects of that generation argumentative, or are these just a special group?
Oh, it's a bitchy profession, isn't it? Sorry about that.
I can't remember all the names. Annie lived with a fairly prominent family, and I can't remember the name of the father, but he was quite instrumental in getting Sulman jobs or positions. Is that so? Annie's guardian, or she lived with the family. I can't remember the name.
Joanna? No, Annie Sulman lived with the family. She was the adopted daughter.
Yeah, but who is the father?
George Masefield.
And he was...
Is that George?
Yes, he helped him in his profession, in terms of introducing him to
clients.
Was
it Thomas Walker?
It was Thomas Walker.
Tell us a bit about that relationship, and they knew the McCarthys, didn't they?
Yes.
They knew about
Thomas.
That
Sulman just knew everybody. I mean, he was very good at networking, so that was his main purpose. Is to, from the very beginning, the very first time he landed in Australia, he met with the most influential people in Stratfield, and that's why he lived in Stratfield, because that's where all the rich people were in the 1880s. And then he garnered invitations to meet other people, and so he met with the Fairfaxes, the Walkers, the MacArthur Onslows, Slice, Dodman, Toohey. He designed for all of these people, so. It's just his talent.
Dr. Edwards, just looking at the slides that you've used here,
first.
Could you comment on the architecture of Sulman? Because it looks at the surface to be just stock standard English Victorian without any particularly Australian features attached to it.
Well, I don't agree with you.
This is
Laurel Park in Burradoo. That's for John McIntosh.
So where's Burradoo?
Burradoo in the Southern Highlands.
Of New South Wales, right?
Yes. And that's a very low building. And then he designed Bishop's Lodge in Hay with a wrought iron roof and all. This is very Australian to me.
But it's derivative. I mean, there would be 100 of those built in the 50 years before he got the
there. Okay, so the suggestion is it's derivative. Okay,
it's derivative, yes. He built according to the climate and the location. So, well, look at this imposing building in Collins Street in Melbourne. I mean, you wouldn't build that in there. And then this is his Christchurch in Springwood. So, and that's a stone one. He built, and this one is St. Anne's in Stratfield, which is a brick one. So this is Manly. Everybody would know the high on the hill, and it's also sandstone. You can tell that they're all different styles. But yes, I agree with you, apart from the Thomas Walker Hospital.
Could you leave that one up?
Just hang on. Here you go.
This one is Armidale, the Armidale School.
Okay, there's a question here. Just hang.
Been a boarder at Armidale.
The question is, having been a boarder at Armidale,
yes.
And the question follows.
And on the board of the school in recent decades, I'd like your comment about the design of that. But from a student's point of view, it's the most imposing edifice. It's very practical in terms of young people getting around. And it is, I think it's dearly loved.
Good.
So the suggestion is this school in Armidale, what school is it?
The Armidale School.
The Armidale School was dearly loved by the students who were there.
Well, because he designed for the students to be protected from the snow and the sleet and the rain and all this. So he designed walkways, covered walkways everywhere, and he designed in solid brick to insulate the place. So Sulman was very, I think it's because of his building background. He knew exactly what to do. It's function before design to him. But it is a beautiful building, the red brick, especially in the sunlight. It really stands out, doesn't it? And he also fought with John Horbury Hunt with this commission. John Horbury Hunt wanted it, but Sulman got it.
There's a question up the back there.
Would it be unfair to say that Horbury Hunt's enmity towards Sulman might have been based in the fact that while Sulman was a quite competent architect, he put much more of his energy into scheming to make contacts, to gain preferment, and to get commission?
Well,
So before you do, can this background Horbury Hunt for us? I mean, who was he?
He was a Canadian architect. He was in Sydney. He arrived in Sydney well before Sulman did. So he was already deeply entrenched. But he was also an immigrant architect. He was an eccentric person. He rode a bicycle and he wore this very...
What did he build?
He built quite a few houses in... the North Shore, Pibrac was one. Can help me with his. And
he built Cranbrook.
He built Cranbrook.
One part of it.
One part of it, not all of it.
Okay.
Yeah. And he built all of these quirky houses all around New South Wales. There was one beside Tass. I can't remember the name of it. But he designed houses with witches' hats and parapets and towers and really gothic, ghoulish sort of buildings to reflect
his suggestion is that Horbury Hunt got stuck into it and Sulman got stuck into arguments. I think that's the suggestion, isn't it? Is that fair?
Very fair. But it was Horbury Hunt who became the president of the Institute and not Sulman. And Horbury Hunt was very clever enough to veil his attacks and put them on record by making them as president's reports rather than anything, so that they were tabled and all that. And it was really quite vitriolic. It was to the point that someone wanted to seek legal advice to sue him for defamation, but it never eventuated.
It's a question there. Yep, let's go. Come on.
It's a sort of frivolous question. I ran an exhibition of for the bicentenary of numbers of architects, and every architect was in Melbourne, and every architect in Melbourne came and fell about with laughter at the about the designs for Newman by Burley Griffin, on the basis that...
Now, hang on. Newman is Newman College
Newman
in Melbourne.
Newman College, okay. I'm sorry. Newman College in Melbourne, and Burley Griffin designed great. Newman College. It's a great building. But they all fell about laughing because apparently Burley Griffin never thought about drainage. And I'm interested so that you could, they'd sort of say, look, look. And one after another came in because it was simply an inadequate disposal of water. And I'm interested in whether whether Sulman, being a builder, actually had issues like that, because it would be getting you commissions, wouldn't it, if you could provide, because there's this famous thing about Frank Lloyd Wright sitting at his at dinner and ringing the client was sitting at dinner at Falling Water, and he rings Frank Lloyd Wright and said, I'm sitting at dinner in a house you designed, on a chair you designed, and water is falling on my head.
Okay, so the question is, was Sulman a drained man? I mean, that's the
question. I must say, the Canberra plan had no drainage from plans for Griffin, and that was one of the problems as well. It was very aesthetic, and Marion was the one who drew the design. It was her renderings, that beautiful, beautiful art renderings.
But Sulman?
Sulman really excelled in building. In effect, that he also constructed or invented or created joining systems to join, for example, walls to each other to enhance the ventilation. He designed pathways and drainage systems himself, which was very apparent at the building of the Women's College that he did, where we located the Jennings brick, which is an S-shaped brick that connected the hollow walls. So he was very particular with that, mainly because he was very particular about building to the climate and making it as natural, the ventilation, the drainage and everything, as natural as possible.
So you've covered a lot of his work in Sydney and other parts of New South Wales, and you've mentioned briefly Melbourne. Just tell us a bit about his work outside of New South Wales. I think he did work in Bendigo, Melbourne. What would be the significant buildings there?
Yeah, he worked for Sargood, in Melbourne. He designed Sargood's house here in Warunga, although Sargood is known for Ripon Lee in Melbourne, but he... This Ripon Grange is in Warunga, which Sulman designed. He designed all the Australian joint stock banks all over New South Wales and as far as Townsville. I know my husband Bruce photographed the Townsville one. So he was all over the place. That's why it's remarkable how he can travel to such long distances. And do all he did in such a short time.
Next question here.
Dr. Edwards, you mentioned some Sydney designs that were not built, and I can think of at least one other. Do you think Sydney's the poorer for those not having been built?
Well, firstly, what wasn't built that he designed?
Well, he designed quite a few New South Wales banks, but they weren't built. I don't know. Solomon was not an outstanding architect. He wasn't a unique one. I mean, he's not in the league of, I don't know whether David will agree with me. His best design was the Thomas Walker Convalescent Hospital. He excelled in that.
So where is that?
In Concord with the Watergate and all of that. So that was his best design, mainly because his budget was not limited. And you marvel, and the Women's College is also one of his better designs, but if you see both of them, they have a similarity, and they were all built within the same period. But then they were built in the depths of depression, and it's amazing how such big buildings were being built when there was no money involved. So there was no money to build the buildings. But he didn't, I wouldn't call him an exceptional architect in the league of, what, maybe the Blacketts, or I don't, it's just my personal view.
Question here.
Dr. Edgeworth, could you tell us how the Sulman Prize, the annual Sulman Prize at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, which I think is for landscape, how did that come to be established?
That was established by the family after his death. It was a John Redd painting. It's a terrible prize. I don't really like it because it's almost, it's relegated to the background, isn't it, David? The winners are, I don't really know what genre painting is. Someone needs to sort of define it more to me, and possibly Judith could define it. But yes, the Sulman Prize was established by his family after his death.
All right, we're getting close to the end here. Is there a question here? Yeah, right.
Dr. Edwards, the Sydney Harbour Bridge is an amazing construction for its time, with 8 lanes and train lines. Would the Sulman Tunnel have had that sort of capacity, considering what we ended up with in the 1990s is only half the size of less? Would they have had the ability, did his plans have that sort of breadth as the bridge does?
What Sulman's design for a tunnel was influenced by the designs in England. And there was talk that he was being he had a pecuniary interest, that he was working for a London company to promote his tunnel design. The tunnel design was quite clumsy. It was going to be run by electricity, and all the passengers would be hoisted up in an elevator. And people were saying, how can you put cows and donkeys and horses in the same elevator as pedestrians and all of this? So it was a work in progress, I suppose, but it was very innovative at that time. Bradfield's Bridge was a copy of Hellgate Bridge in New York, except for the arches. Hellgate Bridge, the arch went across the road. So someone said, well, I stopped Burnett from doing the arch across the road, so that differentiated it from Hellgate Bridge. So I don't know whether the tunnel would have been successfully engineering-wise built. There were so many horror stories about ships colliding in it and all this, and, you know, because it was above, underwater, and submarines sort of, I don't know whether there were submarines at that time, but ships colliding with it and causing a lot of havoc and death and all of this. So it was, I think the concept was very new, and people didn't really know what it entailed.
It could have stopped the Japanese raids in 1942. Okay, we're getting... there's a final question here. Yeah.
I'm not an architect. I'm really impressed what I'm hearing, the questions and answers. Dr. Edwards, thank you so much for inviting me tonight. Actually, my question is just just an observation. I was just listening when you were saying that Solomon was accepted in a girls' school instead of a boys' school. Do you have an indication whether that had affected him in whatever ways? Because he was accepted in a girls' school instead of going to the normal.
Well, I hope he forgot all about it. I mean, he was 5.5 years old. And that would have been a horrific experience for a little boy to be boarded for a whole year in a girls' school. with Miss Parkinson. That was his teacher. But apparently it didn't do any good because he was a mischievous and precocious kid. He was up to, and he suffered the belt quite a lot of times from his father. So obviously it didn't affect him psychologically, which is good. And he had a lot of daughters, which is good as well. So I don't think it had any effect on him.
Okay, thank you. We end on a rather disparaging reference to poor Miss Parkinson, who's not around to defend himself against herself against a potential tunnel builder who wasn't. Look, thanks very much for a wonderful discussion tonight. And as I said, the copies of Denny Edwards' book, A Life of Purpose, A Biography of John Sulman, on sale tonight. It's one of your many books, but and it's got some wonderful illustrations and a terrific index. So, a great deal of detail up the back about precisely what John Sulman did in his career in Australia and before he came to Australia. So, congratulations on that. I can feel a sense here tonight, a sort of sense in the room that perhaps the third Sydney Tunnel should be called the Sulman Tunnel. So I think we can start that campaign. We'll have a chat to Brad Asparagiclian at our dinner. That'll be one of our causes. But for tonight, well done. Congratulations on your book. I'm sure you'll do another one. We'd love to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.